Thank you, my brother. Thank you so much, man.
Go Jets!
Not last week. Hi, family. My name is Alan with Blessed Grapefruit, recovering drug addict and alcoholic. Little business first. Quinn, Kelly, committee, thank you so much for having me here. It is always an honor to do service for Cocaine Anonymous, the fellowship that saved my life. A little other business. Anyone here from Oconomowoc? Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to start with a story that took place in September of 2001. I'm sober a little over 2 years, and I could just about, you know, put together, you know, a couple of bucks to travel, and I have family out in Whitefish Bay. So we decide that we're going to go to Whitefish Bay, spend some time with my cousin, and figuring while I'm out here, I'm going to hit a CA meeting. Go on the website, there's a CA meeting in Oconomowoc. Said, good. The meeting is on like, I'm making up this number, but it's on like 43 Lake Drive. So I go to, it's before the days of Google Mail and my GPS, which I, by the way, I don't go to the bathroom without my GPS. But so I go to Maps, you know, whatever we were using for Maps at that time. I MapQuested it. And it told me exactly how to go. And I got there, and there was no meeting place. And I called this person on the phone, and it turned out that there were 223 Lake Drives in Oconomowoc. So they said, where are you? I told them where they were. I said, I'm on this street and A. Not A Avenue, not A Street, just A. So they say, you got to go to Y. I'm saying, I'm thinking this sounds like a long way away, but I'm going to go with it. So I'm driving A. B. No, don't even get me confused with the side letters, but it seemed like there were a mile in between every letter, and in between every mile, there were another 14 Lake Drives. So I show up at Lake Drive, and the meeting is, as far as I knew, the meeting was from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. Must have had an old meeting list. I showed up there at 8:15, and I sat down, and somebody got finished sharing, and I applauded, and they said, what are you clapping for? I was a newcomer. I said, oh, I figured that was the speaker. They said, no, that wasn't the speaker. The meeting's over. But but we'll let you share if you like. Of course, I didn't quite have as much to say then as I do now. But of course, I took the opportunity to share. And I shared for about 10 minutes. And after that, the meeting made me feel at home. That was very cool. See, but 8 days later, something happened. 8 days later, we had this little thing, the World Trade Center fell down. And New York was not the same after that time. But you know, one of the things that happened with one of the towers that fell down, it had the cell phone tower for New York. So nobody got any cell phone calls for 3 days. That was Tuesday. Friday morning when I got up, my phone rang. First phone call I got. Somebody from the Oconomowoc meeting wanted to make sure that we were okay. I was touched. Well, I want you to know, it gets even better because, you know, in that week between, you know, the time I was in Oconomowoc and, you know, in the time that, you know, this happened, I was sharing at the meeting about all of these Lake Drives and this place in, you know, the middle of bum, you know. So they sent me this phone call, and you know, and they gained some stature. I couldn't really remember what the name of the city was at that point in time, but I knew that it was special. Well, a couple of months later, the first week in December, I get a card in the mail. A couple of people had asked me for my information. I get a card in the mail from the Oconomowoc meeting, and that card wished me a happy Christmas. And a lot of the group members had signed, you know, like their names and, you know, certain things I had said, the card was very personalized. From that day forward, I learned two things. First thing is I learned how to pronounce Oconomowoc. First and foremost. The second thing is that I realized how huge Cocaine Anonymous is. How this thing is all over the place. And up until that time, I had only been to one convention. It was in New York. I live in New York. If it would have been in New Jersey, I could not have afforded to go. Since then, I've made you guys my family. I do not miss world conventions. I want to be with you guys as much as possible. The family of, you know, the fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous has saved my life, and I've been able to experience it on a global level. And that is really how magnificent this thing is. So again, guys, thank you so much. Thank you. You really helped me. Okay, now that we got the business out of the way. Hi, my name is Alan. I'm a blessed and grateful recovering drug addict and alcoholic. I don't know why I just did that again, but I felt the need to do that. Tonight, you guys are going to hear the story of a miracle. Funny that this convention happens to be called Recovery Permits Miracles, I believe. Did I get it right?
Yeah.
Cool. Story of a miracle. It's not like a regular miracle. It's not like, you know, the Mets winning the 1969 World Series. Or, you know, or Moses, you know, parting the Red Sea. Those were regular miracles. My miracle was a little different. My miracle took place on November the 20th, 1999. I was sober for just about 5 months, and I was working in a deli in Englewood, New Jersey. And I showed up that day, showed up on time, and I was on the phone with my sponsor. Because I had started calling my sponsor. I wasn't doing anything else. We're going to get back to this in a little bit. But I had started calling my sponsor. And we spent about 15 minutes on the phone, and when we were done, I hung up the phone, and the guy who was managing this deli comes up to me and says, "You're always on the phone. What's your problem?" And of course, you know, the thought that went through my mind is, "Don't you know who I think I am?" And I think I might have said it to him, because 2 minutes later, I got fired. And I'm walking down Englewood Avenue with no money in my pocket, hungry, not knowing what I'm going to do. And the thought goes through my mind, "I can't believe you did it again. I can't believe you did it again." I grew up in Queens, New York. I kind of grew up in Flushing and in Rosedale. I know that means absolutely nothing to you guys, but I will give you a little bit more information. Rosedale was a little place out by Kennedy Airport, and Flushing was a little place out by LaGuardia Airport. And for some reason, I don't know why, but we moved from Flushing to Rosedale to Flushing to Rosedale to Flushing to Rosedale and back to Flushing. Either my, you know, I figured either my old man couldn't pay the rent, or I don't know what was going on, but we did a lot of moving. And Rosedale was by Kennedy Airport, and Flushing was near LaGuardia Airport, so I was never really sure I was growing up, but there were always planes flying overhead. And I learned something really important from that experience. And that was, I don't have to get to know you guys, because in 20 minutes, I'm leaving. I'm moving, just here, just stopping by. My family was one of those, you know, there was always all kinds of stuff going on inside, but if you asked us what was going on, everything was fine. How was everything? Fine. What's going on? Nothing. Why are you asking? That's the way we grew up. And there was no drugs or alcohol in my family early on. My parents, however, were predisposed with the disease. And I say that because I remember being a kid, and when my parents decided they were going to take up bowling, they bowled 9 nights a week. I didn't see them for 4 months. When they decided they were going to see the, you know, they got into the movies at one point in time, they saw every movie in 4 states. That's the way they rolled. But they didn't drink and drug. But what I did notice is that I grew up playing chess with my old man, and he was always off on Tuesdays, and once in a while on Tuesday, he would have a beer. And I would look forward to those nights, because whenever he had a beer, I could always kick his ass in chess. So we go through life, you know, it's really nothing, and I'm a jock. I'm a ball player. I want to have nothing to do with drugs. My kid brother starts using drugs. I say, what a loser. My little sister starts using drugs. What a loser. I could see it in their eyes. I could see that, you know, that haze, that thing that I hate, the thing that I hated to look at, the thing I eventually hated to become. But I saw that look in their eyes, and I couldn't take it. So my whole family is going through this thing, and getting ready to go away to camp in 1 year. I must be about 16 years old, and we're getting ready to go to camp, and we have an idea. Now, just so you guys know, for the purposes of this story, Anytime I tell you I have an idea, you all should be laughing right off the bat. So we have an idea. We're going to go away and we're going to bring some alcohol with us. And we go to the liquor store and we buy 12 quarts of Tango. And I have found out that Tango is an East Coast thing. A lot of people, you know, on, you know, past New Jersey don't know what Tango is. It's screwdriver in a bottle. And it got its name from Tang, which is what the astronauts drank, and O, which was every time we said when we finished the bottle. So we take these 12 quarts of Tango. It's before liters. There's no liters around yet. We take these 12 quarts of Tango, we put them in the trunk of my friend's car, and we drive up to Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And the first night, we opened up that bottle, we cracked that bottle, and we drank that piss-warm Tango. And I took a sip, and nothing happened. And my other buddy took a sip, nothing happened. And my third friend finished the bottle. My first experience with an alcoholic. Well, he got really sick. He was a blackout drunk. He was the same thing to me as my kid brother and kid sister. That look that we have. But nothing happened. Nothing happened that time. But before the summer was over, I had drank enough Tango to begin to experience the effects that it speaks about in the book. You know, that sense of warmth, that sense of being cool with myself, that sense of, for the first time, being okay, you know, where I am, who I am, where I am at that time. For the first time, I'm okay. Because you have to remember, I'm just, you know, I moved to a place, I pack up, and 2 weeks later, my mom says, we're moving, we got to pack again. So for the first time, I'm okay with everything. Everything is fine. I have come to discover that alcohol was my first gateway drug. You know, I like to say that alcohol is my drug of choice, and cocaine is my drug of no choice. Because once I start using cocaine, there is no choice at all. So for this story, I used with these friends, and these friends, my buddy was a blackout drunk, and I needed to find new friends. And I found new friends, two more jocks. And we get ready to go away to school, and one of my friends has an idea. He says, we're going to try pot. I say, okay. And we go into my basement, and we lock the house up. We put the deadbolts on the door. We pull down the shades. This is real covert activity we're getting ready to do here. And we buy that nickel bag, and one of us rolls this really crappy joint, and we light it up. And as we light it up, we finish smoking, of course, before we answer the door. Then we go answer the door, and it's my sister at the door. My sister walks in, takes one whiff of the pot. She says, where's your brother? He's not here. Oh, then mom and dad must be home, because they were smoking already by this time. And nope. They weren't here either. You're smoking. Huh? Oh, my God. I will tell you that in the subsequent couple months, you know, we were smoking, the whole family was smoking pot. We were having a lot of fun. And not just my mother and my father, my brother and my sister. My aunt and uncle were part of it. And my grandfather really loved grass. But again, I should have known it was going to be a problem, because the first time I smoked pot with Grandpa, we were sitting around the table, the kitchen table, one Sunday night, and we smoked a couple of joints, and we're all done, and we're laughing, and there's Grandpa going through the ashtray looking for more. Once again, I should know that this is going to be trouble. So we smoked pot for a little while, and something happened that I really didn't realize until after I came here, but I started smoking pot in October. By February, I was no longer going to school. I just forgot. But I was still registered. Everyone thought I was going to school. But again, I just forgot to go. And I forgot to go every day. So now we're into this. And my friends and I, we have an idea. And the idea is that we're going to try cocaine. Say, okay, I'm in. Because by this time already, see, I'd only, it was only pot and a little bit of cocaine. But you know, my favorite stuff was yours. Whatever you had was my favorite. It really didn't make a difference. And we're going to get to the garbage head. That's, you know, coming down the line. So we decide we're going to get high. We go out. We get a quarter of a gram, and we go into my basement. Big spenders. Well, we do this quarter of a gram, and nothing happens. I am horribly disappointed. But what happened that night is I was able to go out and drink for the first time. So I went out and I drank 6 Heinekens and I had my first hangover. But you know, the fact that it didn't work certainly did not preclude us from trying it again. And I will tell you guys that it must have been 6 weeks later, my friend said, come on, let's do some more cocaine. We're getting ready to go to my cousin's bat mitzvah. I say, what better reason to get high than that? And me and the same 2 guys in my basement, now we have a half a gram. The progression's going to go really fast from here. Well, we snort that half a gram, and bam, it happens. I am taller, I am funnier, I am prettier, I am faster than I had ever been before. And I will tell you guys, I spent the next 25 years trying to get that thing again, never being able to get it. And I had proof how cool that night was. Because I was at that bat mitzvah, and there's a picture of me that day standing in front of a mirror like this. And around me in the mirror, there are these crystal lights around. God. It was God. We start using everything. Mescaline. Whatever you had, again, whatever you had was good enough for me. I remember a trip on Dazoxin, little diet pills. And I took a diet pill and I thought I was, you know, Dr. Julius Siegel for a few weeks. I had a big afro like this. It was the first time I ever dunked a basketball. It was amazing. It was amazing. And I really thought that I could go anywhere I wanted to go or get anything I wanted to get through modern chemistry. We loved Quaaludes. We loved it all. Whatever you had, we loved. So I'm off. I'm off to the races. And a couple of years later, I decide to tell the school that I forgot to go. So I stopped, you know, so I was no longer in school. And I got a job. And I meet a girl. January 1st, 1980, I meet a girl. And she promises me on the first date that she can drink me under the table. We are married shortly thereafter. The day we decide to, I have an idea. The idea is that we're going to get married. So I know for 12 months, it's December 1980, and I decide we're going to get married, and I decide that, you know, I was going to propose to her, and it was snowing outside that night, and by this time it was snowing inside every night, because, you know, we started off on Fridays. I started off on Fridays. Then we went to Friday and Saturday. Then we were afraid the guy wouldn't have Friday and Saturday, so we used Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And, you know, before long, within a couple of months of that half a gram, I'm using 9 nights a week. I'm only using on days that end with the letter Y. So, of course, it's snowing outside, it's snowing inside, and I decide that we're going to get married. Now, at this time, we lived in the Merrick train station. And I don't know if you guys have such an experience, but there's a Long Island Railroad, and it runs from one end of Long Island to the other. And we're living in the taxi stand of the Long Island Railroad. Little two-bedroom apartment. And we would wake up, you know, at 7:04, 7:08, 7:12. You know, every time a train came by, we'd be rattled out of bed. But in this house, we had a Snoopy calendar. And every day, Snoopy had a little saying for the day. And when I went to write the day we were going to get married, Snoopy said, "Don't do it." I call this my first experience with a higher power, but of course, I have no idea what's going on. We get married anyway, and it's perfect. Every time she lies to me, she brings cocaine into the house. Every time she steals from me, she brings cocaine into the house. Every time she cheats on me, she brings cocaine into the house. I am very happy. My ex-wife was always, we were two addicts just crashing and burning through life. That's what it was. At some point in time, my aunt, who will come into the story later, she's the lady who 12-stepped me. She decided we were going to go, it was before she got sober, so we decided we were going to go skiing in Killington, Vermont one time. So we go up to Killington, Vermont, and my aunt has an idea. And at this particular time, sorry about that, I was the only one who didn't turn off my phone. It was my sponsee calling. I'm off the hook. He's going to be very surprised that I didn't take the call. But he knows I'm here. I don't know why he's calling me. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So where was I? Oh, Killington, Vermont. My aunt takes us up there, and she decides that we're going to go on a trip. So we take this trip called Adam. You've never heard of it. I know that. It's 250 milligrams of MDMA. There should be at least a couple of woes in the crowd. Those of you that are not familiar with the experience, MDMA is the active ingredient in ecstasy. And an ecstasy pill is 10 milligrams. In case you can't do the math, this was the equivalent of 25 ecstasies. And I will tell you guys, it changed my life. Nothing bothered me for like 6 years. I didn't feel anything. I didn't give a shit about anything. You stuck a knife in my toe. Come back tomorrow. We'll be okay. But the funny part about that is that we drove 7 hours from New York to Killington, Vermont, and we never left the room. The next year, we decide to go back to Killington, Vermont. And this is a story about, you know, where I was at that time. And, you know, I was still a little bit hungover from the Adam the year before. But this year, we decided we were going to do, instead of Adam, we were going to do a little mescaline. So we do the mescaline, and I actually make it out skiing. And I think I am a skiing star. Jean-Claude Segal, forget about it. Okay? So I go up and down the Killington Mountain, and I'm skiing, and I'm shushing, and I'm having a great time, and I'm thinking I am the shit. I show up at work the next day. I said to my buddy, hey, I went to Killington this week. He said, how'd it go? I said, it was amazing. I skied the whole... He said, well, what trails did you go on? I said, trails, nothing. I skied the whole mountain. He said, no, no. So he goes out to his car and he brings in a map of Killington. And I remember the name of the mountain that I skied. And it was called Snowshed. It was the Bunny Hill. It was the Bunny Hill off to the side of Killington. I never saw the frickin' mountain. Do I need to go on about how I used? Okay. So you got that. We're all in the same. Oh, before, I just want to say, you know, please do not compare your story to mine. Just identify with the feelings. Because if you try and compare your story to mine, you know, I had like the worst bottom in the world before I get there because it was the one that I experienced. So my ex-wife is always one thing away from being happy. A bigger car, a bigger house, a bigger dog, and we decide we're going to have a kid. And we have this child in 1987. And I am wackadoodle at the time. She's pretty out there herself. And we have this child, and things start to go bad. And 4 years later, you know, in the middle of our addictions, she decides to leave. And she starts using this child as a pawn. You can't see her. You can't do this. You can't do that. She'd make me schlep out there in traffic. And it was just a nightmare. And as this nightmare continued, I started to get lower and lower and lower. Drug use had become way more rampant because it was the only thing I can do. It was my only solution to what was going on was to use more. I couldn't do it anymore. So I have an idea. My idea is that I'm going to stop paying child support. Obviously a well-thought-out plan. figuring that at some point in time, they would call me to the court and they would say, how come you're not paying child support? And I hadn't seen my daughter in about a year at this time. And they would say, how come you're not paying child support? I would say, because I'm not seeing my daughter. And they would say, how come he's not paying his daughter? Because he's not paying child support. And I figured we'd work it out that way, right? Beautiful. So now I move from Queens, where I lived. I moved to Englewood, New Jersey. And I show up at work one Wednesday, and I'm working in the deli I told you about in the beginning. And I see a couple of cops out front. And I go into the kitchen, and they say to me, you Alan Siegel? Yep. You're under arrest. Charge, please. Failing to pay child support and leaving the state. They sent 14 guys with guns and bulletproof vests to get me. Now, before you know, we go on, they sent the FBI to get me. They sent the local cops and they sent the Nassau County cops, 14 guys. And I was nowhere near as intimidating as I am now. Not that I'm intimidating now, but I was 6 foot. I weighed 160 pounds if I had three rolls of quarters in my pocket. And they take me in these three, and I was living in Englewood, New Jersey. And again, those of you that are not familiar, Englewood, New Jersey is literally a driver and a nine iron outside of New York. So I'm not far away. It's not like they found me in North Dakota, in New Mexico. They didn't. I was, you know, I was kind of hiding in plain sight. So they take me in three cars and they take me to the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse at 100 miles an hour. It was very cool. And we go to the Brooklyn Federal Court and they put me before the judge, and the judge releases me on a $50,000 personal bond. Free to go. Now, I was only $49,987 short of having that bond. I had $13 in my pocket, but they let me go anyway. And whereas the federal government was a little mad at me, Nassau County was very mad at me. So now we left the feds in Brooklyn, and me and the Nassau County guys in two cars, again, very impressive, with the lights on the shoulders, pulling over people. It was very cool. They take me to the Nassau County Jail, and I spend my first night in the Hoosgow. And I spend 8 nights there, and I'm afraid, because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen to my job. I don't know what's going to happen to my... I don't know anything. And on the eighth day, I show up at court, and I get this lawyer comes to me, and I meet with the court-appointed psychiatrist, because they were trying to paint me. They wanted to say the reason I didn't pay my child support is I was stupid. So the guy comes to me, and he says, I got good news and bad news. The good news is you're not stupid. Thank God for that. But the bad news is that you knew what you were doing, so we have a problem here. And so I decided to make a deal. And I dealt with my ex-wife. I said, I'll give you $10,000, a car, two fingers and a testicle, and we'll call this thing even. Well, I showed up 2 weeks later, and of course I didn't produce any of those things. And they decided they were going to give me 50 nights in jail. And I was not afraid of the 50 days. I was afraid of the 50 nights. Something happened in jail. 2 things happened on the same day. I am so mocused and so confused, I did not realize that these 2 things happened on the same day for about 8 months. I have a dream. My dream is that I'm playing basketball, which is, I did a lot of that in jail, and I'm in my orange jumpsuit, and I'm dribbling a basketball down a big hallway. And just before I'm about to go into the gym, I look over, and there's a bunch of large guys praying. And I stop. And the tallest guy I've ever seen, he was 9 feet tall, came out, looked down on me, and said, welcome. Bam! As he said welcome, the lights came on. I was startled. I didn't know what it was. That morning I get up, and I stretch, and I rip my orange jumpsuit from right over here to right over here. I'm horribly upset. But my bunkie says, don't worry, they're coming with commissary today. And you know, those of you that have never had the experience, every week they give you a sheet and you fill out what you want, and they come during the week and they bring you your stuff. Well, that day, my buddy said, don't worry, commissary's coming today. And the officers came and they gave out commissary and they never called my name. Call the officer over. I say, what's going on? How come you didn't bring me my stuff? Well, he checks and here's what happened. You see, the first time I was in jail, I had that $13. and they put it in my account. When they let me out, they didn't give me my $13 back. $13 was a lot of money in those days. So when I went back the second time, I said, don't put my money in my account. Put it with my wallet and beeper like this. If I need to get out of here, I can get out. What had happened was I had outthought myself again. But for the first time, I get mad at the right guy. I go over to the mirror in the cell. Oh, sorry, there's no mirror in the cell. There's a shiny piece of stainless steel. I don't want to lead you guys on. So I go to that shiny piece of stainless steel and I say, you idiot. Are you so stupid? Have you done so much drugs for so long where you were incapable of making a good decision? How stupid could you be? And as I'm yelling at myself, they go, Siegel, to the front. And the door opens up. And I go out and they open up the gate and they give me a bag. In that bag is socks and underwear. I go back and I put on the socks and underwear and I'm putting on my orange jumpsuit again, feeling a little more normal. They go, Siegel, to the front. And they open the door and I go up and the guy gives me a ticket. He says that the first 7 days that I was in jail was coming off my sentence, so I only had to do 43 days. And as these two things happen in a row, I must have this puzzled look on my face, because the guy who has the jailhouse store, and I'll explain that to you in a second, there's one guy in every cell block. I don't know if you've all seen Oz before, but there's one guy in every cell block who has all kinds of stuff. And he'll give you his stuff as long as you give him back double your stuff when you get it. So if he gives you a cookie on Wednesday and you get your stuff on Thursday, you got to give him two cookies. Well, the guy who has the jailhouse store comes up to me. His name is Jason. Another Jason. Where's Nate? I deal with Jasons all over the time. Private joke between he and I. So this guy, Jason, comes up to me, puts his arm around me and says, you're a good guy. He says, you can have anything you want, even if you can't pay it back. Well, I'm here to tell you guys that within 15 minutes of the time I finally blame the right person for my problem, I had everything I needed. Next day, I get another package. A big book and a 12 and 12. You see, my aunt had sent me the socks and underwear. The next day, she sent me the big book and 12 and 12. She did not think that she could send the big book and 12 and 12 and then the socks and underwear. Obviously, she nailed it. So I get the big book and 12 and 12, and I open up the big book and I start reading. And I read the first page and I fall asleep. And I read the first page again and I fall asleep again. For the next 3 days, I got plenty of sleep. As a matter of fact, I got so much sleep that when I got sober and I couldn't sleep, my sponsor would tell me to read the first page of the big book. When I got to the fourth page, doctor's opinion, started talking, it mentioned my name. It didn't say Alan, but what it did say is I have obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. Once I took one, I couldn't not take another. Once I initiated that phenomena of craving, I couldn't stop. And it said alcohol. So here's where my golf skills came in. I'm left-handed. So when I read a golf magazine, every time they say left, I have to say right. Every time they say right, when they say keep your right elbow in, they really mean keep your left elbow in. Okay? When they say follow through with your left hand, they really mean follow through with your right hand. So wherever they said alcohol, I said cocaine. And something happened. And I read those next 160 pages in a couple of days doing what it said. And it turned out that I did the steps and I didn't even know it. So I had the luxury of having a spiritual experience of the white light variety, followed by a spiritual experience of the educational variety within just a few days. So now I'm in jail, and I can't wait to get out. Because I can't wait to get out to see what's out there. You see, I had been to AA meetings before. I had been to the 79C workshop back in 1991, which is T-minus 8 years for me. And I loved what you guys had. I loved it. I wanted it. I was not, however, willing to do anything to get it. I want what you have, but I have to stop using? I don't think so. You may have to stop using. I'm not ready. But I like to say that my recovery had three different phases. The first phase is threatening to recover. Whenever anything was wrong, I would threaten to recover. If you don't behave yourself, I'm going to get better. You better watch yourself. If you don't cut that out, I'm going to start doing these steps. You better watch yourself. That went to, you know, I was in those meetings. I was loitering with the intent to recover. I was sticking around. Again, I really liked what you guys had. And I intended to recover. I did not, however, intend to stop using. I thought those things were completely, I don't know why you're making me stop use if I want this. And I saw lots of people. And I said to my aunt, I love what you guys have. And she says to me, well, what's going on? I said, I'm going to make more friends. She says, how are you going to do that? I said, I'm going to drop all my standards. Guys, in case you didn't know it, that was another one of my ideas. So now I finish this bid in jail and I'm ready to get out. And getting ready to go out, and they take me from the cell block where I was to the checkout room, for lack of a better word. I don't even know what they call it. And I'm in the checkout room and I meet a guy there. And the guy I meet there is a guy who I'd gone to high school with 25 years before. He was there for some other child support thing. And so we're there, and he said to me, where do you want to go? I said, I want to go to Forest Hills. Forest Hills is where I live now. Forest Hills also happens to be where my family's deli was. Forest Hills also happens to be where my dealer lives in my old apartment to this very day. And this is, we're going back 11 and a half years. I say to the guy, take me to Queens Boulevard and 67th Road. And he takes me there. And something happens. And I go into my pocket to pull out the quarter to call the guy. For the 1,000th time. I had called this guy from that phone 1,000 times before. And before you say 1,000, he may be getting a little carried away. I used every day for almost 20 years. That's about 7,000 times. I was not an 8-ball guy. I never saw an ounce in my life. I was a nickel and dime user. I was a half a gram user. You know, I was not afraid of overdosing. I was far more afraid of the lethal underdose. So I go to that place, and I go to take the quarter out of my pocket, and it comes to me. The guy who was in cell 10, I was in cell 9, told me I was going to use the next day. And I said, no, I'm not. I read this stuff. I did this. I'm good. He said, you're full of shit. You're going to use tomorrow. And I took that quarter and I put it in my pocket and I ran into a meeting of Cocaine Anonymous. See, it was not my first meeting of Cocaine Anonymous. I had been to Cocaine Anonymous before at T-minus 2 years. But, you know, my first 90 and 90 was 90 grams in 90 days. I went to the meeting. I heard the message. The message was cocaine. I went out and used. But I ran to that meeting that day, and I sat in the corner, and I heard a great speaker. And I was charged. And at the meeting, they said, is there anyone here for the first time? And I stood up. I said, my name is Alan. I just got out of jail. I'm really glad to be here. They said, sit down and relax yourself. We'll let you talk in a few minutes. And during that meeting, a guy in the corner started talking about having a new life and new friends. And I got up in the meeting and I said, I want what he has. And they said to me to sit down and relax. They'll let me talk in a few minutes. I went to that guy after the meeting, and I said, I want what you have. And he said to me, if you want what I have, you will do what I do, because as long as you do what you did, you will get what you got. I said, what? I'm a newcomer. I don't understand a word you just said. That's another one of those things that I, like, you know, came to realize a little bit down the road. And but that was a Thursday night. That was Thursday, November the 4th. So that was Thursday, November the 4th. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, I was busy working. I didn't have time to go to any meetings. So, of course, I didn't have time to go to meetings. I didn't go. Wednesday, I went to Miracles on Madison. I meet this sponsor. I am really excited. I'm really ready to do this. And he asked me these couple of questions, and I'm in and I'm down. But then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, I'm too busy to go to meetings. Wednesday, I meet him at Miracles on Madison, and he says, "What's going on?" I said, "Listen, I'm really busy. I'm trying to get my job back. I'm trying to get my life back. I'm trying to make all these things happen." And he says, "Okay." That was Wednesday. Thursday, Friday, nothing happened. Saturday, I show up at work, and my sponsor reads me the Riot Act. "You got to go to more meetings." He says, "I don't give a shit if you go at 6 o'clock in the morning. I don't care if you go at midnight. This one or two meeting a week stuff is not going to work." And we have this 15-minute conversation, and I get off the phone, and the guy who owns the deli comes up to me and says, "How come you're always on the phone?" And I said, "Listen, I always need to be on the phone. There's not a thing I can do about it." He says, "You're fired." Oh, that's where the story started. And I'm walking down the street saying, "I can't believe I did it again." Well, I walked to my house in Englewood, New Jersey, and I scoured my house for $5.10. That $5.10 was a round-trip fare into the city. I went into the city. I went to a meeting at Hazleton, the Woodshed meeting. It's still there. It's not in Hazleton anymore. It was in the Eric Clapton Hall. Beautiful building. It was incredible. And I sat there, and I said, "I'm glad to be here," and they welcomed me. And after the meeting, somebody came up to me and said, "We're going out to dinner after the meeting. You want to come?" I said, "Maybe you didn't hear me. I don't have any money." Guy said, "I don't care if you have any money. We want to hang. You want to hang with me?" Yeah. We went out that night. We went to a pizza place, and we went to listen to music. And the next morning, I got up, and I went to a meeting at the Gay and Lesbian Center in New York. I am neither gay nor lesbian. And it was great. It was great. It was amazing. And I've been here ever since. My ride back to New Jersey changed from "I can't believe I did it again" to "I can't believe I finally did it." That guy who took me out to dinner, we were like this early on. He was my running buddy. If you tickled him, I laughed. That's how close we were. About 3 months later, he relapsed. He picked up again. And I call my sponsor, and I say, "How can he do this to me?" Because, of course, it's all about me. And he says to me, "He didn't do it to you." He says, "We use. Addicts, alcoholics, drink, and drug. We're the miracles today. We do not need to drink and drug. That's what this thing is about." And I wanted this. I wanted this like I never wanted anything in my life. But at the same time, I was still a little skeptical. Time to start working the steps. Powerless and unmanageable. Yep, you see, I used to think that manageability was knowing when Con Ed was going to shut off the power. So I would pay it the day before, not only did I know when Con Ed was going to shut off the power, even knowing when Con Off was going to shut off the power, I missed that a couple of times. I heard a newcomer said, "We admitted we were powerless over cocaine and all other mind-altering substances, that our lives had become unimaginable." I said, "How did you know?" "How did you know?" I wanted this. But again, I went kicking and screaming. We talked about a second step, sanity. Restore me to sanity would infer I was sane at some time in the past. I had a large problem with that. He asked me for 5 examples of a power greater than myself. I had nothing. And the drugs were the only power greater than me that I had experienced. He suggested that I go to the Hudson River and try and keep the sun from going down that night. I did. I am happy to report that it did go down that night, and it has been going down every other night in my sobriety. Make a decision to turn my will and my life over to this power I might or might not understand. And that's okay. I make that decision every day. I do the best I can. See, the only thing I have to do perfectly every day, first step. Everything else is progress, not perfection. Everything else is up for negotiation. Everything else can be worked at another time, as long as I don't pick up a day at a time. Fourth step. Searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. Took me a long time. It took me a long time because every time I had a resentment, it was like having a baby. I was pacing. I would spend Saturday nights, I would say, well, I'll tell you, it started at a retreat. My fourth step experience started at a retreat where my main resentment is my mother. So I get my four columns and I write down, Mom. Told me she didn't love me. My beeper goes off. It's my mother. I can't call her back. I just have a beeper. I'm away somewhere. I call her back the next day. I say, Mom, you'll never believe what happened. I said, I'm just doing my fourth step. It's about resentments. And I wrote you down and you paged me. She said, resentments? I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have any resentments against you. You see, that's where I come from. Going down the line, admit to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. I sit down with my sponsor for 3 weeks and we play Can You Top This? Every time I thought I said something that he would say, listen, sorry, you got to get out now. He beat me. He had something crazier. He had something crazy, and it was just amazing. You know, I heard one of my all-time favorite fifth step things at a convention in Denver. When a guy shared about, you know, he was at a step meeting, and he talked about, you know, having sex with a chicken. And somebody came up to him after the meeting and asked if his chicken died too. So what that kind of means to me is that if you've done anything in here, been there, done that, if it's got a name, someone else has given it a whirl already. I go to step six. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I was entirely ready. See, I've been doing this four and five thing for a year. And I was about to go to my sponsor and say, listen to me, I couldn't be any more entirely ready to do this. And if you're not entirely ready, I'm ready to move on. But he was entirely ready. So then I went from having 48 defects of character to having 54 shortcomings in step seven. I don't know how that happened. That's my experience. Make a list of all persons we'd harmed that became willing to make amends to them all. I make that list, and I'm ready to hit the streets. Made amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I go, and I try and make things right. And you know, you're supposed to have three columns. Amends you will make, amends you might make, amends you probably won't make. I needed a fourth column. And that is, amends I'll never fucking make. You see, my ex-wife was on that list. So I painstakingly write a letter talking about, you know, what went on in the past and, you know, how we had some good times. And I read this letter to my aunt, who's my spiritual advisor. I read it to my sponsor. I read it to everyone in my network, and I sent it out to her. Actually, I sent it with a check, $100 check, figuring she might or might not respond to the letter, but I knew she'd cash the check. So she cashes the check, and 2 days later, I get a call from the Nassau County detectives. Mr. Siegel? Yep. I got a call from Miss. She says you're harassing her in the mail. I said, excuse me, officer, she said what? You're harassing her in the mail. I said, officer, did you happen to read that letter? He said, no. I said, how dare you call me? He said, excuse me? I said, how dare you call me? Please get a hold of that letter. If you still want me, you know where to get me. I never heard from him again, never heard from her again either. She's still mad at me. We're divorced for 17 years. I'm sober for 12. She still hates my guts. I tried to make amends to my daughter. I've not been able to. I will tell you guys that I tried to invite my daughter to my 10th anniversary. And within 4 minutes of sending my daughter an invitation on e-invite, I got a hysterical call from my ex-wife. How could you do this? All kinds of crap. And a few days later, my daughter calls me and says, I appreciate what you're doing, but do me a favor. Don't contact me anymore. She says, it upsets my mom too much when you call. And I got off the phone. I said, if you ever reconsider, you have my number. And I have not contacted her since. You see, I know where she lives. I know where she goes to school. I can impart my will on that situation. But my amends to her is to not contact her until she's ready. And that hurts. That hurts to the bone. But what I will tell you guys is that my first year of sobriety, when this whole thing was going on, I had to choose. I had to choose sobriety or dealing with my wife, ex-wife and daughter. And I chose sobriety. I pay a price to stand here today. It was the best deal I ever made. I would not trade anything for what I have at this moment. Get to step 10. Continue to take personal inventory, because I am wrong way more often than I'm right. And when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. Doesn't say admit it a couple days later. I promptly admit it and move on. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. When I came in here, I prayed for two things. I should win the lotto, and my ex-wife should die. I'm using, guys. It's not pretty. But I have since prayed for my ex-wife. And you know, it says in the book that you'll pray for 2 weeks for someone and you'll forget what you're mad at. That wasn't the case here. Is that not what it says?
No.
That's what it says, but it wasn't the case. It wasn't the case in this one. Then, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, what that means is that if you do this work, you get one result. It's not a result. It's the result of working these steps. We have the spiritual awakening, and we try to carry this message to addicts and practice these principles in all our affairs. I love my guys. I love my sponsees. Okay? A lot of them are crazy and Friday night in a nut house. That's okay. Practice these principles in all my affairs. I will tell you guys that just before my fifth anniversary, my sponsor called me into the hospital. He had colitis and something else like that. And he called me into the hospital and at his hospital bed, told me I had to find another sponsor. You see, he relapsed. And I went downstairs and I called someone. And I said, how could he do this to me? Again, how could he do this to me? And then I remembered what that man told me, that he didn't do it to me. We use. That's what addicts and alcoholics do. And he was afraid to come back here. He was afraid of being judged. He was afraid of being a newcomer. He was afraid of sitting in this room. And 15 months later, he died of an overdose. And he died feeling unloved. And I went to that man's funeral, and I was in the middle of the procession, and I couldn't see the first car, and I couldn't see the last car. He was loved, and he didn't even know it. I went out and found another sponsor. Great man. 1 year later, he died as a result of this disease. He had some liver problems. And he was diagnosed with like liver cancer on Thursday, and on Monday he was gone. It's scary what goes on in here. But what I learned from the first sponsor, the guy who died of the relapse, he had 11 and a half years when he died. I had 11 and a half years last month. I'm afraid. I'm afraid of going back to that life. I don't ever want to be there again. So what do I do? So I do exactly now what I did when I came here. Exactly the same things. I go to the same number of meetings. I sponsor guys. I do the work. I do service whenever asked. Because you do not graduate from here. There's no graduation. There's no, I'm feeling better. I don't think I need to come here. That does not happen. You know, once you open up that Pandora's box, you never know what's going to happen. I've heard it said that relapse is like fucking a gorilla. You're not done until the gorilla says you're done. You know, you guys can get that, you know, I'm just going to do one and I'm going to be okay. Once you wake that up, boys and girls, it's all done. How am I doing on time? I'm good? I got plenty more. Okay, cool. So what do we do today? Whatever's asked. My sponsees are the most important thing, you know, in my life. You know, if you ever want to know how crazy a guy is, you ask him how many sponsees he has. I'm crazier than most. I probably have about 200. I have like 7 that call me every day. But I have like 200 that have said, you'll be my sponsor. Yes, gone. And every once in a while, you know, I'll have one of those guys and he'll sit in the room and he'll say, he'll put up his hand and he'll share. He says, Al is my sponsor. And I'll go to him after the meeting. I said, I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't go around telling that to people. You haven't done anything. But I was telling a couple of guys this story that I'm looking at the Daily News about 4 weeks ago. And I open up the paper and I see one of those guys' picture. One of those guys that tried to came here and couldn't get it. And, you know, I was a sponsor in name, but not in any work. And he stabbed his mother and father, killed him, and jumped in front of a train. That's what this does. You all have subways in Milwaukee? No. Not an issue. That's what we do. I don't know how I go from sad to happy in 1 second. It's crazy. But that's what we do. We drink and use and we hurt people. We hurt ourselves. More lessons there. More lessons there. So what I do is I keep doing today what I did when I came here. I do service whenever asked. I'm so grateful to be able to come here and be with you guys today. You know, Quinn said, you want to speak at our convention? I say, sure. The second question is, well, when and where is it? I really don't care. Because when I came here, I had nothing. I went nowhere. You know, I started off by telling you guys if that 2001 convention wasn't in New York, I could not have gone. I would go anywhere to pass the message of Cocaine Anonymous. You know, my experience, strength, and hope means something up here. CA saved my life. I could never, ever repay you guys for this incredible life that I have been given. You know, some of the things I've been able to experience in my life, a couple of years ago, I tried skydiving. Jewish guy jumping out of a perfectly good airplane. It was great. It was great. I learned how to play the drums in sobriety. I joined the rock and roll band. I grew a ponytail. I had 2 earrings. I was really funky. I could do anything I want in here. You know, I am only limited by my thoughts. I'm only limited by my dreams. I can go way past that, you know, with the higher power of my understanding, you know, one day at a time, just trying to be in the moment. Because when I'm in the moment, everything is okay. I don't worry about what happened yesterday. I don't worry about what happened tomorrow. I just take one good action at a time, and everything is okay. You know, when I was out there, things were crazy. Things were really crazy. Things are different today. I was going to go back to some using stories, but I don't want to go there. Sobriety is the best game in town. I will tell you guys that I know 1 million ways to not stop using. I know them all. There is only one way to stop using. In here, with these steps, with these traditions, with you guys. My gratitude could never be expressed. My debt could never be paid off to Cocaine Anonymous. And I am a straight up Cocaine Anonymous guy. I don't do AA, I don't do any of those things. And I have very, you know, steadfast reasons for doing that. You know, I went to AA meetings with cocaine in my pocket. Said, I'm sober, I didn't drink today, look at me. And, you know, I went to NA meetings, and no disrespect, but I never understood what was going on there. You know, at CA, we use the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I appreciate that. And I have been to Nicotine Anonymous meetings. And I never smoked, and those guys think they're drug addicts, and good for them. And I have been to Overeaters Anonymous meetings, and I only want to know where we're going to go to dinner after the meeting. Wherever they have 12 steps on the wall, I am home. But Cocaine Anonymous is my family. Cocaine Anonymous is my life. When I think about the incredible gifts I've been given here, some of my favorites are first, the relationships I have made in Cocaine Anonymous. Because when I came in here, I had no friends. I had no one. I had no money, no friends, no place to live, nothing. Because if there would have been one smoldering stick still standing up in my life before I got here, I would have pointed at it and said, I'm not done. I lost it all. But I have friends beyond my wildest dreams. I have friends that are real friends. They don't just care what I'm bringing to the table. They're there for me at all times. And I love that. Another thing I love to see the light come on in newcomers' eyes. I love to see that moment, that aha moment that they have. Because it's obvious when a lot of us walk in here, the lights are off and there's nobody home. But to see those people come alive, to see those people help other people, that's what this is about. That is what this thing is about. It's about giving. It's about giving what was freely given to me. You know, I shared at a meeting before. I was shocked early on that my sponsor didn't send me a bill every month. Services rendered. I stayed sober. I have saved a lot of money on drugs and alcohol in the last 12 years. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. Cocaine Anonymous did not just save my life. It gave me a life. And once again, I could never, ever repay the debt. I want to thank you guys a lot for my sobriety.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you.